Thanks a lot, Tanya, for that wonderful introduction. And this session is very special for me because when I met Jim as I was preparing, I kind of had a taste of his deep knowledge and passion in the field of org design. And I would like to introduce him as a maker, as a coach, and he's worked with very large organizations like RBL, Bose. He has an engineering background. He's done electrical engineering. He's a technologist at heart, and he has then transitioned to executive leadership, transformational change, org design, team performance coaching, operating and profit model design, enterprise and business architecture. So there's a huge, huge wealth of wisdom right here in front of us, and I'm looking forward to this session with Jim. So welcome, Jim, and thank you so much
Hey, thank you,
for your
Rahul.
time.
I'm going to share my screen here, and I hope I get that done properly. And we want to go here. What did we do? I think we got
You got it.
it. I got it. Okay. So the title. Generative AI and times capabilities equals macro organization design. What we've been working on recently is understanding this generative AI world and how to use it. And we sort of stumbled across a former partner of ours who was really getting deeply into it, and he said we were missing the boat. And I asked him where. He gave me a list of three things and said, "You ought to be able to do these things in less than a week, very, very well." And so he laid down the challenge, and a learning challenge is all I need to get me going. And sometimes I will immerse in that for days at a time. Until I know what's happening. And therein is the engineer in my background. So my advance button isn't working. Just a couple of highlights here, and I'm going to go from almost the top to the bottom here, is that I'm a learner. I will learn almost anything. I used to read the Journal of New England Medicine, as well as the Electronics World magazines, et cetera, et cetera. And you could read in the middle there, but let me get down to the fun stuff, which is I'm a contributor to the local STEAM program. Is everybody familiar with STEM? Science, technology, engineering, and math? Well, I added art to it here in Wilmington, North Carolina, where I live. And our program is a STEAM program. So we incorporate art. And if you look in the background over my shoulder, you'll see an aquarium, and you'll notice that all the fish are inanimate. Those are glass fish that my wife and I made. In the background is some glass kelp that I made, and some wood, driftwood that we've woven into a very low maintenance aquarium. Over my shoulder. The lighting comes from Lego sets, and right above that is a Lego train. And what I do is I design experiments for the kids in the STEAM programs, and I send them off to the middle schools and to the YMCA, where they hold STEAM events. And they give those assignments to people. And one middle school adopted it, and they built a weather station with tracking information that they provide to the local farmers in the area about how much rainfall did they get, how much humidity was in the air, infrared, et cetera, et cetera. It's great fun. I don't participate with the kids at all. Everything I do is remote. I started it when I was homebound for almost 6 months, and we continue that way. GLOW is the Girls for Leadership of Wilmington, and that is a leadership development program. And I contribute lessons and learning to that as well. And then on the end there, the World Blind Union, and that's an international organization that works to address the needs and desires of the blind people. And what I do there is I write code that takes digital books and it reads the books and it eliminates everything from the books that doesn't translate well when converting from text to speech. So for example, where there are 14 exclamation points, I reduce it to one. And if there are squiggles and scrolls, it doesn't give the name of the squiggle or scroll from the EBCDIC library. It just eliminates it and it says page 4. And that's interesting work. We have just hit 700,000 books that have gone through the system in the last 15 years, mostly contributed by Google, but also by some very well-named authors. Author Nora Roberts writes as J.D. Robb, and we get those books from her publisher 2 years after the hard copy edition has been on the market, and they're at no charge to blind persons for text-to-speech work. And I also dabble with the Adaptive Leadership Network, strategic doing and organization design. If you're not familiar with Adaptive Leadership Network or strategic doing, you might want to jot those down and just take a look. They've got a lot to offer, even if you're just listening in. So I need a volunteer. Somebody volunteer? Or I will draft somebody. See, I don't have enough. I only have six people on my screen, so I can't.
So maybe if you'd like to volunteer, you could click at the bottom of the Zoom screen and raise your hand, and then that'll pop you into the front for visibility.
Quick, it's not a hard question. Name an organization that you admire, somebody.
And in case you all can't talk, you all could just type it in the chat as well.
I would say Patagonia.
Patagonia, one of my favorites. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a few questions about Patagonia.
Sure.
What do you admire about Patagonia?
How they're very value driven. They have defined the values and they live for them.
Okay. How many layers of management are there at Patagonia?
I actually don't know, but it sounds like it's a fairly flat organization and fairly collaborative.
Okay. What's its process model?
Can you define more process model in what context?
What's the flow of work through Patagonia that takes cloth and fabric and others and turns them into actual products that people buy?
So you're talking about because they have different divisions. In terms of the apparel, I think they try to, again, like ethically source their materials and then produce them in a matter. And like I think the other thing that I really admire about them is they think about the afterlife. So they try to encourage you not to buy more, but actually to repair or even donate. So the clothes last longer and it's not a consumeristic type of company.
So of those questions about layers of management and process model, how much do you think those contribute to your admiration of Patagonia? Your understanding of that contributes to your admiration?
Layers, not at all. I think process, yes, because it actually highlights how they're living up their values.
Okay. So here's the last question. What is the organization capable of that others are not that causes you to admire it?
I think they take a stand for that we believe them. A lot of organizations that I either work for or know of are very much profit driven. This is an organization that stands for more like value driven to the detriment sometimes of like potential their revenue, right? They've cut some revenue streams by not, for example, sponsoring big corporations anymore because that does not align against their like towards, well, can't speak today. It doesn't align with their values. So I think they're very clear in terms of like their values and how to drive those ones.
So they have this ability to demonstrate their values very publicly. So I just happened to have worked for Patagonia quite a while ago. And the purpose of Patagonia is to purchase $10 million worth of rainforest and preserve it every year. So Patagonia is profit driven. They need to drive profit so that they can buy land and preserve the rainforests of the land. Now, how they go about that is in their values, as you described. So, what the point here is that when we think of prosperous companies, when we think of companies that we admire, all of those structural things that are inside the companies really don't matter to us. What matters to us is how we perceive them and their products on the outside. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at organization design from that perspective, is what capabilities does the organization need to have for it to fulfill its purpose and live its values. And those two become anchors, purpose and values. So we'll see how that develops. What you're looking at here is a capability model. And this is for a not-for-profit company, a global not-for-profit, whose purpose is to end childhood malnutrition. And I'm going to ask you what you see on this. And put your hands up just as you look around. First, I'm going to bring you to this corner here, up in the upper right-hand corner called contribution. So, and that is how does this capability contribute to being able to fulfill the purpose and live the values of this organization? And a little cheat sheet down here on the bottom is that it creates distinction. People admire this company. Investors want to invest in this company. Communities want this company to operate in their neighborhoods. And then at the opposite extreme, we've got necessary. This capability, the blue ones, you just got to get them done. It's like filing your taxes and keeping the lights on. No matter how well you do it, doesn't make any difference to your customers or your investors in the company. And then we've got two others. There are support. Support directly enables distinctive capabilities, and essentials drive the financial aspect of the organization. So we love our two by two boxes. When we're asking people to make decisions. So what we do in organization design is that we say at the senior most level, what creates distinction for your organization in the marketplace? And then we also ask them, what drives your financial success? What drives costs down without any defects? And what drives revenue up or profit up. And that gives you a competitiveness score. So what else do you see here, though, in this diagram that would be helpful to organization design? What does it look like to you?
It looks like an activity of taxonomies or a taxonomy of activities.
Okay, what else?
A value stream? High
Value
level?
stream. Yeah. So from left to right, value gets built for the end customer and the organization. What else?
It describes the work of the organization.
Describes the work. What else?
Jim, I liked the distinction, differentiation with distinctive support, essential, and business necessity, and then the matrix over there on the bottom left side.
Yeah. What else jumps out at you?
Abigail says, puts a focus on culture being the basis.
The business puts a focus on culture. Well,
It also looks like they're building the capabilities they need to be distinctive through the tasks in the value chain.
so now
interesting. Thanks, Eva.
you can get a lot more out of this. I'm going to ask, so how could this help you in designing the organization?
I think that can help clarify interactions, kind of like a service blueprint to say like where different teams play. Is it one team that is just focused on one of these activities or subset of activities? It could also help you understand in terms of like talent. Do you have the talent to re require to support all of these activities? Do you need to outsource that talent, and do more of like that talent management per se?
So I was working with a biotech company. They make their product, as it were, is a protocol for gene therapy for orphan diseases of children. And that is children whose life expectancy is less than 12 years because of genetic defects. That company created a capability model, and it may be three times as many capabilities as you see on this one. They created that in 3 weeks. They then looked at it and said, hey, what if we had a director of brand and advocacy, a director of global partner networks, a director of new products, a director of supply chain? And they were accountable for delivering all of those capabilities below them in the diagram. And we said, what prevents that from happening? And they essentially said, well, we're all in the room. What do we think? And they said, let's do it. So we went from zero to a designed organization in 5 weeks. They then explored who would be in the next level. So that's where we're going to work towards, is how do we get this, and then how do we get from here to an operational system? And now that organization ran for 90 days, and they did a complete review, everything, all the capabilities, all the contribution assessments, et cetera, et cetera. And they made a lot of revisions. They also looked at the reporting relationships that they had set up. And they moved a few people around, that it would make more sense for this person to be over there, even though they were valuable where they were. So we go ahead. There's a question.
Yeah, we have a hand by Janet. Janet, would you like to share?
Hello, Jim. I'm smiling because I've literally just finished a functional review for a nonprofit organization based in South Africa, not as big as this. But I took a very, very similar approach, and I asked them, what are the things we need to be insanely good at doing in order to achieve our mission? We came up with six things we had to be insanely good at doing. The first one was build brand and advocacy. The second was develop partnerships. It starts to shift a little bit from there, but it was just so funny as this came up. I thought, oh my goodness, this could be my diagram. It's a little model that I've played with in some other organizations, and I really passionately believe that this is a very important principle for design, especially in rapidly growing organizations. I'm smiling.
Great. So I just put out a couple of things to carry forward as we go through. One of them is the capability definition, which is it is a combination of technology, process, talent, and culture. The next is the idea of the support, distinctive, necessary, and essential categorization of capabilities. And then the third is the hierarchical nature of capabilities. And the way that we come to that, if you go over to 5.1 over here, provide production facilities, and you'll notice it's got a 1.1 and a 1.2, a 1.3 and a 1.4. And that's because it was not possible for these people to measure the effectiveness and efficiency at this level. They could only measure it at this level. So the requirement for understanding is to only go as deep as you need to in order to be able to measure the effectiveness and efficiency of the capability. So that, as somebody pointed out, you can come back and you can decompose the deficiency or the surplus or the lack of capability into four components: a technology component, process, talent, and culture. What you can find is that a capability's performance could be deficient because of deficiency of one or more of these layers. Now, the really interesting thing about that is that once you've decomposed these, your technologists, your process designers, your talent management, and your culture management teams can all work in parallel to build the course of action to transform the organization from where it is to where it needs to be in the future. And again, we will come back to that, but those are the key things to carry forward. A couple of definitions of terms here in the way that we work with this. One is the concept of the state change. If anybody out there uses that, congratulations. A state change is that something happened that is largely irreversible. And the analogy is when the Spanish landed in Florida to explore the New World, they burned the boats. They couldn't go back until the next ships came a year later. So there wasn't a question about these mosquitoes are terrible. We got to get out of here. There is no place to go except north, where it might be colder and we won't have so many mosquitoes, and therefore St. Augustine. So the idea of the state changes is important because there are a couple of things, and we'll get a reminder later, but there are a couple of things about them that are important. One is that you never break a team across a state change. So you don't have two separate teams contributing to a state change. You embody everybody together in that work so that team works from state change to state change. It's also a really good place to start doing measurements of performance of the team and of the capability that their team is delivering. The second one is the fractal nature of organizations, the way that we work it. And that is that an organization is simply individuals or organizations working together to fulfill a common purpose. In that parlance, a football team is an organization. Three people helping change a tire for someone on the side of the road is an organization. The United States military is an organization. The United States House of Representatives is a disorganized, no, never mind. So the next term is this idea of co-design. And that is you bring in all the disciplines into the design process from the get-go. And you start with a small core, and then you expand that core over time to include everyone who is going to be impacted or contributing to the transformation that you're going to make to a new future state. And that leads to the idea of orchestration. Is you don't lead an organization design, you orchestrate an organization design. So you're not making the music, you're orchestrating the music, and you're helping people or you're directing people to create the music. So it's the idea of the separation of a coach facilitator from the smartest person, organization designer in the room. You may be that, but that's not what you portray, and we'll come into why that happens in a minute. The next is that there are two different kinds of challenges. There are technical challenges, ones where you pretty much know the solution. My flat tire example. You know what to do. You just go about and do it. Although I would probably stand there and try to convince myself that it's not really that flat for a little bit before I actually opened up my wallet, called AAA, and asked them to come and change my tire. And then there are adaptive challenges, and that's where they're vague. You don't really know what it is. You don't know all the implications of it. Think of COVID-19 as an adaptive challenge that we all had to face. None of us had ever faced that before. We didn't have a certain solution to go after it. The methods used to resolve technical challenges are counterproductive to addressing adaptive challenges. Although the methods of adaptive challenges are conducive to solutions to technical challenges in almost every case, they just take longer to get there. So recognizing that you've got a technical challenge versus an adaptive challenge is an important thing for you to do.
There's a question by Ashley in the chat, and she says, can you give a positive and a negative example of teams applying the state change principle? That is, teams that do X break up work across state changes, but teams that do Y are not breaking work across state changes.
Yeah, it falls
positive
into
and a negative example.
It falls into process flow. So when working on the process flow, let's say you've got a set of tools that are fairly complex, and you use them to perform some actions. And I'll use that as the case of measuring ingredients and mixing the dry ingredients to make a cake. Okay, so it's not a good idea to, even though you could do this, to mix all the dry ingredients except the baking powder, and then add the baking powder when you're mixing in the wet ingredients. Why? Because you now have to duplicate tools, you have to duplicate skills, and knowledge. And you have to carry the recipe, the mixing recipe, across an organizational boundary, a team boundary, from one side to another. So you just build in overhead. Now, these are principles, which means they're statements of perfection. So there are violations to it for certain reasons. But if that's your starting point, then you will almost always end up with a flow of work that is more efficient and more effective when you do that. That answer your question?
Yeah, it did. That's awesome. I really like the whole mixing versus measuring. You use a common verb, ingredients, but instead of mixing them, now I'm measuring them. It's the same verb. It's just the change of the state, or the change of the verb makes it easy to find those things. Thank you.
Yeah. And there's sort of an interesting thing about that. I said that at Merck and Company to a group of scientists and chemists rather, and they explained to me that once you've mixed the salt and the baking powder, the flour and the baking soda together, you can reverse that. And they proceeded to try to tell me how. And I said, yeah, okay. So you can, but I can't in my kitchen because I don't have distillation columns and all of the other apparatus that you have available. Okay, so now there are ways of thinking, various ways that we think about organizations. One of them is the hierarchy of power. Who's the boss of whom and who's in charge of what? The other is process. How does work get done? Often what we end up doing is combining process design with the hierarchy of power. So we design the processes so that they fit who wants to report, who is going to report to whom, as opposed to designing the process and saying, let the process tell us who reports to whom. So we're going to change that around a little bit. And then the other is capabilities. So what the organization is capable of doing and delivering. And there's a reason here, and we're going to see if it works here, is we're going to jump over to Gemini's artificial intelligence. And I'm going to bring up a couple of things here. First is, I'm sure everybody is at least somewhat familiar with generative AI. Basically, you pose a prompt and it gives you a response. So, but Gen AI doesn't always use the same language that you use. So what we need to do if we're going to use generative AI to help us with organization design is we have to define some terms and we have to express some points of view about things. And so this first prompt simply is setting the stage for the future prompts. So when I use it, I use certain language and I use certain points of view, and I want you to understand those and apply those as opposed to your own points of view that you've learned from other sources. So this is an override, and it's generally referred to as contextualizing your agent. Unfortunately, you can't go across boundaries. You can't go across prompts. So what I have is a very long prompt. It's probably two typewritten pages of prompt that I put in, and then I ask my questions, but I've simplified it for you here. But you can express a point of view. You know, for example, don't break processes across state changes. And then you can train your AI agent to work with it. So here are a couple of things that I've done. And just as I tend to be a polite, I speak to my agent as if it were a person when I'm working with it. And I very often have found myself learning the English grammar that I actually thought I learned back in the sixth grade, when writing sentences and posing questions. So the idea here is to influence Gemini's responses by crafting.
Jim?
Yeah. Yes. Sorry. I don't think we can see your screen.
You can't see that?
No, okay. No. Sorry. You're seeing comments in here, and I just sent Tony a note. Like, is it me?
Stop share, share again.
All right. Thank you.
We'll pop over to this one.
Thanks, Cynthia.
How'd we do?
All right, good.
Yes.
There.
And I'm going to make that a little bigger. How's that?
And I'll give a quick tip for folks who aren't always on Zoom. They've added a new update feature too. There's three dots at the top next to Jim Dowling's screen is being shared, and you can individually zoom that in closer if you would like to.
Yeah. Okay, so let me give you an example here about capabilities. So this first one, this is a company that I follow, you know, being an engineer and having worked on building nuclear reactor control systems, I'm interested in investing in micro reactors. And so I posed the question, what capabilities does NanoNuclear display that differentiate it from others that compete for my time, attention, and money? So you can use that plug in if you have an agent available to you. You can plug in and then put in whatever company, Patagonia, and it will give you a starting point of understanding about the language. So NanoNuclear is, they have scalable reactors. They have a reactor for a 10,000 home household community up to a 40,000 household community. All that fits on the back of a 40-foot tractor trailer truck. They reduce construction time, so they can set one up in less than a month. They can go from no electricity in the middle of nowhere, Alaska, to a fully powered community in a matter of months. So it's just an idea. The concept here, though, is that if you get a weird answer from a prompt, it's probably because of the prompt, not because of the system. You will also find up here, OpenAI and Copilot all behave differently. This one works the best for me for the work that I'm doing with organization design. So let me show you a more complicated one, which would be, it always starts at the bottom, and I have to go back to the top. So here's that preface, which is, please consider these preferences when responding to further prompts in this chat. Not all chats, but this one. And it politely comes back and says, sure. And that's a good place to see, did I get my prompt right the first time? Then you can say, apply these preferences and list the capabilities that are required to operate a bakery that creates custom cakes to customer requirements. So now I ask, please elaborate the baked cakes capability. And then I made an error, and I even spelled it wrong, in the third preference. Please restate all capabilities providing a why. So now you can see the adjustment coming in. So rather than teaching your co-design team all this sort of technical jargon and academics behind capability modeling and capabilities, you just dive in and use generative AI for your industry, your challenge that you're facing, and see what it says. Play with it for about a half an hour before you introduce it to your co-design team at the work, and then say, okay, so now knock yourself out. What capabilities do you need? And now you can divide the work among the people who have the interest, communities of interest in the various capabilities moving forward. So this goes on and on and on. And please close your eyes for a second while I scroll down. So restate, this is an interesting thing that I picked up, and that is, please use this example and restate store cakes, maintain cake freshness would be one capability and maintain cake quality would be a separate one. So split the capability into two. So it had one cake, one here, maintain freshness. Excuse me, I should have shown you this above. Apologize for that. The word and sometimes indicates that two capabilities are combined. Please avoid that construct and restate. So now it restates it. But here it used an and, transport and presentation. Apply icing, fondant, and other decorative elements. So I ask it to restate by decomposing anything that is combined with an and. It maintains the other rules that have been set. And you get a more clear capability statement about decorating cakes and transporting cakes. Do you see how that can help? Anybody have a comment as to where you might use that in your practice?
So I didn't raise my hand, but I just put in the comments. I really like this, Jim. I definitely can see how, especially putting the prompts in, just really defining what a capability is first in the Gen AI, and then refining it to a certain industry or company that you're working with. So mm-hmm. I think that's really helpful.
So what is,
the definitions are, to me, one of the hardest things to really help a team understand what is meant by that.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Once you've got the method you're going to use and the language you're going to use shared among all of the co-design team members, things go really fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I worked at a very large financial services company. They did health insurance, property and casualty insurance. They did business continuation insurance, life insurance, et cetera, et cetera. They also did annuities and 401k kind of investment management. So very complex, very big company. Started out with a project to take a significant amount of money out of the IT cost basis. We were benchmarked, they benchmarked, and our goal was to take out $75 million a year in operating costs from the IT organization. We ended up with $135 million coming out, and reducing and increasing the number of releases per year from 3 to 6, and in 2 increments. We went from 3 to 4 and then 4 to 6 increments over time. So we created 3 visions of the future state, and then a capability model for each of those visions of the future state, and then a course of action to realize each of those 3 visions. With the goal that the challenge would have been met and the organization would be more adaptable in the future. That required about 15 people from the corporate IT organization that rapidly exploded to 150 people in the IT function in a working the wall to refine the capability model and what might prevent us from being able to realize that capability at that performance level. Next came finance to call finance renovation. And that project started with four people from IT coming onto the team and teaching the other members of the team all of the principles and the methods that we were going to use in a day event, day-long event. They said that that took 2 weeks of haggling off of the typical launch of a project of that magnitude. Our last project with them was 6 years later, project number 17 or 19, I think it was 17. That project was to design a bank, a commercial lending institution. And that project was, they stood the bank up in 180 days, and then they did a review and another review, et cetera. So the idea is once everybody is speaking the same language and using the same tools, things start to accelerate. So we've got that capability syntax.
Jim, we have Ashley who had his hand raised. Ashley, would you like to share?
Sure, sure. If you go back to that cakes thing, I'd like to just drill in 1 second. There was a cakes description. It was like develop cake designs and then like wherever that was. And I want to come back very, very briefly to what you said earlier about not breaking teams across state changes. Would you say a develop cake design to bake cakes is a state change? And if it is, you would therefore do well to have a end-to-end team that's going to do developing designs and baking and decorating and storing and packaging.
Well, the I'm not sure I'm catching the whole drift there. Is the state changes you don't have a design till you do have a design. You don't have a baked cake till you do have a baked cake. And you don't have a decorated cake and then you do have one. So those are the state changes.
Okay.
Does that matter?
Yeah, it does. It does. I'd love to talk about this with the offline, though. Thank you very much. That was a great description.
Always available offline. Well, almost always.
Thanks, Ashley. And Jim, we have a question by Larissa, where Larissa mentions, what's been your experience with validating the outputs of the AI engine? And Larissa is referring to qualitative aspects such as language, depth, and logic. And Larissa finds that it requires a lot of editing prior to sharing with others. And I can totally resonate with that experience as well. So yeah, interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and here's the guidance. Adapt, don't adopt. So adapt what the Gen AI, whatever these models tell you, adapt it through a lens of your own knowledge and experience or a group's knowledge and experience before you put it to use. So if it tells you to do something a certain way and that just doesn't make sense to you, try working your prompt to be more precise on the prompt that you gave it until it gets a little bit closer or as close as you can. And then even at that point, apply your own sense of what can be done and what you're comfortable doing. Then look at what you discarded and challenge yourself to rationalize or to justify having discarded it. And that's where you sometimes hit the aha moments. I never thought about that. So as an example, I put in at one point a prompt around what is the ecosystem of a hospital operator like Johns Hopkins. And it described the ecosystem as being everything inside the control of Johns Hopkins. And I said, what if you extend the ecosystem to the enterprise of Johns Hopkins. I then said, what if you extend from enterprise to ecosystem and you get the aha moment of neighborhoods community norms of competitive organizations, et cetera. And then you can say, okay, expand that even further to suppliers to and partners with Johns Hopkins Hospital. And you get a whole nother view. And the aha moments popped all over the place. Our project was to reduce hospital-acquired infections by 30% in 9 months. And what the AI agents came back with was, and this was quite a while ago when we were dabbling with it, what it came back with was the very simple statement, and that is, don't bring infections that into the hospital in the first place. And when you think about that, it's really stupid until you ask the question how, and it says set up community clinics where you can have people with raised temperatures and et cetera, and they can come in and they can get their antibiotics and the antivirals before they ever enter into the waiting room of the hospital where a lot of infections get transferred. I mean, how come they weren't doing that? Nobody had thought of it. Most of their work was done. How can we get people through the waiting rooms faster? How can we make them more comfortable in the waiting rooms? They were solving the wrong problem because they were dealing it as a technical problem, and the AI agent inferred out of the problem statement that it was really an adaptive problem. You need to think outside the box of the organization. Okay? We're going to pause. Go ahead.
Just in the interest of time, as we have a lot of listeners, we have about 5 more minutes for the session content. Just wanted to remind our viewers, and Jim has been very gracious to offer 30 minutes more for any Q&A and any questions that you might have. So feel free to hang on post that as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm going to share something different here. I'm going to go back to the PowerPoint, and we're going to go down a ways because I really talked about a lot of these slides as we were going through that. Are we back on the screen?
Yes.
Okay.
Back to the slides.
Back to the slides. So one more thing here, and that is, so what do you do first? This is now changed to a different view of the capability model called the HEAP. And what it says is that your hotspots, your worst performers, are in configuring current facilities and being able to work in places where we don't have a presence. So the heat map tells you where to go first. And so that's assessed by differentiation and financial contribution. And you use that as a factor along with effectiveness and efficiency to suggest an order of investment in fixing this. And again, it's a suggestion. If the same people are required for both of these, and you've got 25 extra people kicking around that could be working on these other ones, you go for it. But what we're trying to do here is to guide the politics to be explicit. Don't just declare that the projects are going to be invested in this order. Explain why you're not following the suggestion of the heat map. Doesn't eliminate the politics, but it helps you to manage the politics. So I talked about this a little bit. So what we take is we've got capability requirements up here. And we then take the process slice out of that, and we lay the processes out that are required in order to deliver that capability. And we establish where the state changes are that take place. The big state change takes place between process 2 and 3 and between process 3 and 4 in this case. So now we break that out and we say, okay, that those are going to be designed together so we can put metrics on them. We can then decompose those to tasks, which require skills, and we can combine tasks together where the skills are complementary and where an individual is likely to be able to have proficiency in the skill and can fulfill a role. So we want to fill roles on teams as definitions of jobs that take place on the teams. Doing that with current practices would cripple the HR organization. So you need different thinking. And the thinking is dynamic directed teams, is teams that form around getting work done. And then they dissolve. The people move in and off of the teams. The teams that set up a process and get it operational move on to set up another process. Some of them move on and some of them stay behind going forward. My favorite story on that was the crash of the third and the fourth Ruth's Chris Steakhouse restaurants. They absolutely crashed and burned. And when we worked with them on that, the problem was that the setup teams were not the best in each of the different skill categories that the kitchen needed and the service department needed, the front of house and back of house, as they called it. The problem was that they left too early and they didn't have the right people in there in the first place. So we redesigned the startup teams, the startup team structure, to get everybody that was necessary in there, and that some stayed behind for an additional 30 days before moving on to their next assignment or going back to their restaurant that they operated in before. Any questions about this?
Jim, I had a question here regarding this journey of capability requirements from inputs to outputs. So this seems to be a very linear process. And what we are hearing from customers, clients, is that they want non-linear processes, something that are more radical, something that's quicker, something that's emergent, rather than leaning towards linear processes, which could be more time consuming, because just the state of the business, state of the way things are. So what are your thoughts on that argument?
I need to know more about what you mean by a linear process versus an alternative to a linear process.
What comes to mind is something that isn't linear. It could be exponential. It could be something that's quicker. The rate of production is faster. It leads to quicker shipping, quicker deliveries. It leads to innovation. And it isn't an engineering linear mindset as such. It's more...
Can you give an example of a transformation from linear to something different? Or we might be talking about the same thing here. Let me describe this. So yeah. Supposing this is our baking the cake. So we've got a measuring ingredients process, and we've got a mixing ingredients process. I'm not saying that these happen in a linear fashion, but you can't mix them until you've measured them. But you don't have to mix, you don't have to measure everything and then mix it like they do on TV with the little glass bowls, where they have pre-measured and they throw everything in from the little glass bowls. You could be doing these simultaneously. that's what happens in the pharmaceutical business all the time, is that you're mixing and you're measuring simultaneously. So this flow says that you can't mix something until you've measured it, but it doesn't say you have to measure everything and then mix everything. So if you've got a production process where you're not doing it that way, you've actually got a mixing department, you've got a measuring department and a mixing department, which a lot of companies used to have back in the olden days, is that they used to have an inventory control or an inventory management department that measured out all the portions of everything before they sent it out to the production line. Well, the new model for that is a little bit different. But the implication here is that this can't happen until this has happened. You can't put the engine on the chassis until the chassis has been made. But you can be putting engines on chassis while chassis are being made. You just have to start up the chassis line before you start up the engine line, so that things arrive all at the same time. And I actually saw a great example of a team of robots learning how to weld a framework and put dashboards into cars. And the programmer sitting there watching while the machines learn how not to bump into each other and how to reorder work. Any other questions there? No. Okay.
Nothing in the chat for now, Jim.
Okay. So, quick thing: small team, create vivid images of the future state where the challenge is met, and that's your vision statement. From vision, you enlist others to broaden the images, and then you identify the capabilities required by the future state as realized. You assess the capabilities for desired and actual performance. You validate the capability model with additional co-designers, and you just keep going around and around and around until you've got a substantially correct capability model. It does not need to be perfect because there are future steps here. You then ask, what might prevent us from realizing each capability? That might add a capability. You ask, what must we do to mitigate those risks that might add a capability or might change some? How do we close the capability performance gaps? Those are your courses of action. And then what's the primary contributor? Collect the gap closure actions into groups, form a course of action to close the gaps, and then the steps of project management to execute off of that.
Jim, there's a question in the chat by Jack. Is this relevant or similar to continuous improvement?
So if you look at continuous improvement, the way we think about it is that continuous improvement takes place within a process team. It does not need a project manager. Doesn't need all the project management disciplines. It benefits much better from the Japanese concept of the tiger team. You know what the problem is, and those are very good at solving technical problems, technical challenges. They don't do quite so well. They tend to founder when the challenge is an adaptive challenge and they don't recognize it. Because what they do is they treat the cause of a symptom as the root cause of the challenge. And so the symptoms go away, but the root cause remains. So we, in IT, very common, we architected the application wrong in the first place, and we've been patching it for 7 years. And now we're spending 50% of our time trying to figure out how it was supposed to work because of all the patches, and we're drowning in legacy debt. The other type is the larger scale complex problems and challenges that you come against. And those require the disciplines of project management. And we recommend Scrum, the Agile Scrum methodologies for those, and not the waterfall methods for those, unless it is highly repeatable and extremely large scale. I cannot imagine putting up a skyscraper using Scrum. It's not going to happen. It won't get done. But I can imagine, and I see it all the time, I can imagine resurfacing the runways of an airport using Agile.
Thanks.
So it is complementary. It's just that choice of where you do it. Now, the worst of the two is when you move continuous improvement to project management disciplines. The administrative overhead is horrendous.
That's a lot of food for thought. Thanks for sharing, Jim. Jack, I hope that answers.
So where are we going? For me, an organization design. We're collaborating with a firm where my partner and I have also a retired guy. We're senior executives, and they are generating what's called a CLM, a custom language model that sits between the interrogator and the large language model. So that's a term that's not used very often, but it's actually in the parlance. And so we're working with them to take a capability model and to add purpose to it. So what I'm working on myself is getting into the Google Cloud services to prepend Gemini prompts with points of view and definitions, so I don't have that overhead of copying and pasting that huge set of prepended points of view and definitions. And then another is, there's a term that I didn't get to here called anchors. We'll keep that for a lightning session, which I'll talk about in a second. But what we want to do is to start to embed the anchors into the custom language model so that it knows more about what's going on. And anchors are pre-made decisions. For example, our customers are the upper echelon Blue Cross Blue Shields, not all Blue Cross Blue Shields. And they are specifically New York, California, Massachusetts, and Florida. That's our target customer. We design everything for them because everybody follows them. And that's the rationale. So once your custom language model knows that, it can make decisions based on that. So extract capabilities into projects. That work is already being done, and I saw a demo, and it's terrific. It's based on ServiceNow, but may be brought to a tool that would be accessible to me because I don't use ServiceNow. And then another piece, which I want to get to once I've understood this Google Cloud Services usage, is to use the hooks into Microsoft Teams, where you have the profiles of the people, and you can use that to construct your teams based on the skills and knowledge, skills and abilities that are necessary for the project to be a success. That capability, by the way, is somewhat available in ADP's personnel management system, human capital management system, and to a slightly lesser extent in Workday. If you already have Workday, take a look-see. Okay. What's next for you? I didn't need to have Maven up here. Maven is down here. But we have courses coming up in February on capability development. which is the basis, the core of this is how do you actually create and use capability models in a lot of different ways. We've got the framework of data that leaders need to lead through adaptive challenges being scheduled for January. And my partner Rich is creating a new course called Project Agendas to New Realities, which actually uses the custom language model to drive a project agenda and to continuously renew that agenda. Another thing to look for is that I'm conducting a series, not connected series of lightning sessions on Maven Learning. All of this is Maven Learning on topics suggested by course and waitlist registrants and or adaptive challenges that pop up along the way that I run into. I just did one on the use of generative AI and organization design. They're 45 minutes in length. They've broken into two pieces, 25 minutes of lecture and 20 minutes of Q&A. And they go real fast and they stay on a very specific topic and don't try to get too complicated outside of that topic. Are there any questions I can answer for anybody? Like I say, I just keep going on this until supper time.
Thanks a lot, Jim. I'm just going through the chat and it's flowing with a lot of appreciation and gratitude towards you for sharing your approach, your experiences, and they just keep flowing. So yeah, it's great to see that.
Yeah, all the slides are going to be provided to you. And you will see some additional content in there. Feel free to reach out and suggest a 45-minute lightning sessions. Those are free, by the way. Those lightning sessions are free on Maven. And I will put together a lightning session on any topic that seems to be popular, or I'll just get right back to you in an email.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Jim. And the session has definitely given me some notes and some points that I would like to explore regarding CLMs, regarding capabilities, and how we sort of look at different categories of it. So thank you so much, Jim, for sharing. And I know you have a vast knowledge in this and your passion is palpable. And thank you, everyone, for joining in. I know we have a lot on our plate. You all have a lot to do as well. So I hope this was worth your engagement and your time. And we will look forward to seeing all of you again with our next ODF session, which will be coming up soon.
Thank you, Tanya. So and thank you to ODF for providing the platform and keeping us informed.
Very happy to have you join us and share your wisdom today, Jim. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. And I will send out a message to everybody who registered to let y'all know when we've got the recordings and Jim's deck uploaded and available on the website. So other than that, Jim might hang around. I can hang around if anybody has any questions in general about the community. So we're happy to stay on here for a little while. Jack, I see you asked how to get a hold of them. When I send out the email to let folks know that the recordings are available, I will CC Jim so you can get his email directly from that message. Do I have any news about the 2025 conference in Denver? I am expecting in the next week to have some information to share about keynotes, and we'll be reaching out to follow up. We received 38 submissions for peer-led sessions, and we'll be following up with them in the next few days, the ones that were selected from our peer review process. So I think about 10 of the 38 were selected that'll fit into the slots on our agenda coming up. So be looking for an email on that coming out. Fingers crossed I get my stuff from my presenters over the next week and can share something other than just, hey, register because you know you love us and you're going to come no matter what. So Hopefully that's...
Oh, that's exciting.
Pause recording here.